Okay, so the reading today is John chapter 19, verses 1 to 16, and you can find that on page 1087, but you're all there ahead of me. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe and went up to him again and again, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they slapped him in the face. Once more Pilate came out and said to the Jews gathered there, "Look, I am bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him." When Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to them, "Here is the man." As soon as the chief priests and their officials saw him, they shouted, "Crucify! Crucify!" But Pilate answered, "You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him." The Jewish leaders insisted, "We have a law, and according to that law, he must die, because he claimed to be the Son of God." When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid, and he went back inside the palace. "Where do you come from?" he asked Jesus, but Jesus gave him no answer. "Do you refuse to speak to me?" Pilate said. "Don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you?" Jesus answered, "You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin." From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free, but the Jewish leaders kept shouting, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." When Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judge's seat at a place known as the stone pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabbatha. It was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about noon. "Here is your king," Pilate said to the Jews. But they shouted, "Take him away! Take him away! Crucify him!" "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asked. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priests answered. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified.
Whether it's A Few Good Men, To Kill a Mockingbird, or Trial of the Chicago Seven, maybe L.A. Law, anyone old enough to remember that? Or Rumpole of the Bailey, Piers' favourite. Watching a courtroom drama unfold has often been a popular form of TV entertainment, hasn't it? And that is in some ways what we have before us in those verses that were just read. As we jump back into chapter 19 of John's Gospel, the cross is hours away, as it were. The hour has come, Jesus says. He's heading towards the cross. And where we are today is Jesus on trial before Pilate. And so it's as if you and I are in the public gallery. We get to watch, we get to listen what's going on. But it's an interesting public gallery, because if we look to our left, we get to watch and listen the conversation between Jesus and Pilate inside the palace. But if we look to our right, we get to listen and watch the conversation between Pilate and the Jewish leadership outside the palace gates. So we're in a privileged position this afternoon, because we get to hear what's going on both inside and what's going on outside as well. So we're listening to the trial of Jesus. Although, as I hope will become clear this afternoon, as John narrates it for us, we see it's not so much Pilate doing the judging as the one being judged. And it's not so much Jesus on trial as the Jewish leadership who bring him to trial. So I want to begin by turning your attention to what Pilate says to the crowd in verse 5. They're gathered outside, and Pilate presents Jesus to the crowd and says, "Here is the man," or "Behold the man," as it would have been in earlier translations, which I think really gives the sense of what Pilate is saying. Because he's holding up Jesus and he's saying, look, as you look, what Jesus do you see? What sort of Jesus do you behold? And I think that's important because in many ways, that's the question John is wanting to ask us this afternoon. And that brings us to our first heading. Behold the man. See, as we pick things up in chapter 19, the crowd who've been waiting expectantly outside, they're not privy to what's just been happening inside, which is the second half of chapter 18. So let me recap. The whole trial under Pontius Pilate, who's the Roman governor, it begins rather bizarrely, really. We're told it's early in the morning, and the Jewish leaders turn up and present Jesus and ask him to be executed. So this is sort of from verse 28 of chapter 18 onwards. We're told then, verse 28, this takes place outside the palace because the leaders are concerned about ceremonial purity. It's Passover time, which isn't just a meal one evening, but a week of feasting thereafter, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. But you can only partake in that if you're Jewish and you're ceremonially clean. And if they're to step foot into the Roman governor's palace, they would be deemed ceremonially unclean. So they want to say outside of the palace. They don't want to defile themselves. So they present Jesus saying, can you please kill him? All the while seemingly oblivious to the fact that someone onlooking might consider their attempts to get an innocent man killed something that might make them unclean. They seem oblivious to that. So they just present Jesus to Pilate, and Pilate, not unreasonably, asks the question, well, what are the charges? Verse 30 is quite extraordinary. Pilate says, what are the charges? And they say, well, they don't give any evidence. They don't give any charges. Just the statement, well, if he were not guilty, if he were not a criminal, we wouldn't have brought him, which is no real argument at all. And yet that's what they say. If he were not a criminal, we would not have handed him over to you. And as a result, without any evidence, the trial begins. So it's no wonder as we go through it that on three separate occasions we're told Pilate, as he interrogates Jesus, finds him innocent. Three times we're told that. And that is, of course, because Jesus is innocent. But that doesn't stop the trial going ahead. And so as we're picking up things in chapter 19 and verse 1, despite Pilate being convinced of Jesus' innocence, he has him flogged anyway. I think that's because he hopes that sort of beating Jesus up a bit will satisfy his enemies and then they'll leave him alone and he can get back to his breakfast. So he presents Jesus as now a beaten, broken man and says, behold. But it invites that question, who is it that they see? Who is it that we see? Because judging by what Jesus has been through in verses 1 to 3, he may not be all that recognizable as Jesus anymore. So behold the man who bleeds when he's flogged. Behold the man who bruises when he's beaten, who now stands before them broken, weak, and helpless, as one who understands firsthand suffering. As we will sing a little bit later, behold the man of sorrows. So as we begin, we can be in no doubt this afternoon that the man whom we behold in chapter 19, Jesus in all his fragile humanity, means he can sympathize us with us in our weakness. Jesus knows what it is to feel brokenness. He knows what it is to feel pain. That's important because it means that Jesus doesn't just empathize with us. That is, he doesn't just comprehend something of what we might be going through, even though he's never been through it himself. No, Jesus, the man, can sympathize with us because he is a man of sorrows. He's a man who's been there himself. He knows what it is to undergo physical brokenness. Jesus knows what it is to undergo emotional brokenness. Jesus, the man, knows what it is to be abused and mocked and stripped of dignity and ridiculed. Jesus understands. And so when we face those moments in our own lives, when our hearts are troubled because of shame or confusion, perhaps when our minds are tormented by recollections of abuse or humiliation, well, let's not forget that Jesus knows and Jesus understands what that's like. He has been there himself. He is not some distant deity. He is the man Jesus who knows what it is to be human and knows what it is to be fragile. He is a fellow sufferer in that sense, who can truly sympathize with us. But Jesus doesn't just offer sympathy. He also offers strength to us. Because as we read on, we see that Jesus is not only with us as one who suffers, but he is one who is for us, who suffers in our place. You see, the man that we are to behold as we look at John chapter 19 is no ordinary man. Behold the Son of God. See, for Jesus' enemies, his enduring this physical pain and public humiliation is not nearly enough. Six, they see him, and their response is not to say, fair enough, Pilate, let's all go home. No, they shout, crucify, crucify. They are determined to see Jesus executed, indeed crucified. They know they have no right to do that themselves. That's why they're knocking on Pilate's door. The capital punishment was the right of the Romans. But why is it they call for crucifixion in verse 6? The Romans had a number of different death penalties as options. Why does crucifixion matter so much? I think it's because they're very keen to make sure that should Jesus die, he's not seen as a martyr by anybody. But in his death, he is despised. When people look at his death, they reject him as well. They see it only as condemnation because crucifixion carries with it nothing but shame. It was forbidden for any Roman to be crucified. In fact, Romans would say to parents of young children to avoid any area where crucifixion was so that children never even saw it, set eyes on it. It was full of shame, not suitable for a Roman. But more than that, as a Jew, we read in Deuteronomy that if one is crucified, they're not only under condemnation from the state, they're under the curse of God himself. That's why they want crucifixion. So they can point to Jesus and say, cursed by God. And yet, ironically, the Jewish leaders here, as we saw with Caiaphas last week, in calling for crucifixion, they go on to speak beyond their own understanding. Because in verse 6, Pilate follows this up. He says, let you take Jesus and crucify him. I find no charge against him. He's innocent. Now, if the Jews want Jesus crucified, they can't do that themselves. Pilate knows that. And they know it as well. And so this leads them to go beyond the simple, he's a criminal, please kill him, to start making accusations against him. And the first accusation, we have it there in verse 7. That is the accusation of blasphemy. Jesus says he is the Son of God. He claimed to be the Son of God, verse 7. He claims to be divine, this Jesus. He claims to be able to forgive sins, and no one can forgive sins but God alone. He claims to be the I am, God. So when they behold the man, they see a blasphemer. Now on hearing this, perhaps a little bit surprisingly, Pilate, we read, is even more afraid. That might not be the response we were anticipating from him. And we can't be entirely sure why this scares Pilate. It may be that he's afraid or fearful because he's beginning to realize he's in so deep he might have to go through with this crucifixion business despite his own conscience. Jesus' opponents are not going to let this slide, and so he feels like he's on a one-way track now to having to condemn an innocent man. That might be why he's afraid. Or he may be fearful because of the possibility that if Jesus is the Son of God, he might be in trouble because he's just ordered him to be flogged. We can't be entirely sure, but what does happen next is helpful because Pilate goes back inside to interrogate Jesus further, and he asks a most very important question there in verse 9. Jesus, where do you come from? It's interesting, isn't it? We know he's Jesus of Nazareth, but Pilate wants to know where he comes from. And that question matters a great deal because it determines how we answer that question determines how we will respond to Jesus ourselves. If he is from Nazareth, so what? If he is from God, that's a different story. So as we watch from the gallery, who do we behold? that carpenter from Nazareth who's just disturbing Pilate's breakfast plans? Do we behold a blasphemer like the Jewish authorities who deserves arrest and punishment? Or do we see the man as the Son of God, man, who deserves our adoration and allegiance? Because what John's out of his way to make certain as we read through his gospel, John's gospel, that's one of the four historical accounts we have of Jesus' life. What John wants us to grasp is that the man that stands before them that day is the Son of God, man. John makes this very clear at the very start of his gospel. Here's the first word he writes. In the beginning was the Word. That's John's way of describing Jesus. In the beginning was Jesus, and Jesus was with God, and Jesus was God. So John is showing us that, yes, Jesus is the man in his fragile humanity, but he's also the man in his divinity. He is the Son of God. So yes, human, son of Mary, flesh and blood, the floggings have shown that to be painfully all too true. But Jesus is no flesh and blood man like you or I. He is the Son of God man, which makes him a man like no other. That's who John wants us to behold in chapter 19. Of course, he's given us plenty more evidence throughout his gospel, plenty of signs, as John calls them, that point to the fact that Jesus is the Son of God. And if John is right, if the man is the Son of God man, well, he's not guilty of blasphemy, is he? See, it's only blasphemy if you claim to be God and you're not. Well, Jesus has shown himself to be God on numerous occasions. And yet, to quote one of those movies I mentioned earlier, the truth about Jesus is what the Jewish leaders, they feel threatened by Jesus' power and authority and teaching. They can't handle the truth. They want to bury it. They want to bury him. But as Jesus goes on to explain to Pilate, how we treat Jesus really matters. Because if Jesus is the Son of God, well, how we treat him really matters. So back up to this conversation with Pilate in verse 9. Jesus, where do you come from? Now, this time round, Jesus gives no answer. That's not Jesus being rude. That's because back in chapter 18, Jesus was answering Pilate's questions, and he explained how his kingdom is different from any earthly kingdom. Because Jesus' kingdom comes not with force, but by the truth its king proclaims. Pilate turned around and said, I don't really care about truth, Jesus. I'm not going to listen to truth. Therefore, Jesus will no longer speak the truth to him. But because Jesus is not speaking, Pilate presses on further. Jesus, answer me. Do you not know how powerful I am? Here's a power play, if ever there was one. Pilate says, look, you need to speak to me because I have the power of life and death over you. I can order you to be crucified and you will die. Jesus' response is remarkable. He basically says, Pilate, you're not really very powerful at all. Because he points out that Pilate would have no power at all were it not given to him by God. And what's more, the only reason Jesus is there before him now is because God has planned it so. The real power belongs to God, not Pilate, Jesus says. And although Pilate, Jesus makes it clear Pilate is guilty for the part he plays in all of this, that's why in the creed we said earlier, crucified under Pontius Pilate. Pilate didn't wake up this morning wanting to kill Jesus. It's the one who handed him over, Caiaphas, who is actively seeking Jesus' death, Jesus says is guilty of a greater sin. Caiaphas knows the Old Testament. Caiaphas should know better. But what's striking here is how Jesus is defining sin in relation to how they are treating him. Why does he do that? Well, because of who he is. Because he's divine. Because he can forgive sins. Because he is the Son of God. And so to reject Jesus is to sin. Their refusal to recognize him as who he is, their refusal to listen to him as the Son of God, their refusal to bow the knee to him as the Son of God, well, that's the real blasphemy, isn't it, in this passage? See, to claim that you're the Son of God when you're not, yes, that's blasphemy. That's what they accuse Jesus of wrongly. But to claim someone is not the Son of God when they are, well, that's blasphemy as well. Behold the Son of God. We must move on. So finally, verse 14, having brought Jesus out before Pilate sits down in the seat of judgment and he says, here is your king. Final heading, behold your king. Whilst we've been told the plans for the coronation of Charles III are to be toned down compared to those of his mother all those years ago, nevertheless, in 6 weeks' time, 6 weeks today, several thousand people will gather inside Westminster Abbey. Many more thousands are likely to be outside on the streets, and who knows how many more watching online somewhere. And they'll all be watching to witness the coronation of the king. There will be trumpets and song. There will be ceremonial robes, a scepter, an orb, and of course a crown. It will be a very different sort of coronation in 6 weeks to the one we read of at the beginning of chapter 9. Yes, they crown Jesus. Yes, they clothe him in a robe. And yes, they hail him as king. But the crown is one of thorns. It brings hurt, not homage. The robe is one of mockery, not majesty. And the hailing, well, it's abuse, not allegiance. It's accompanied not with trumpets, but with fists. So let me ask one final time, as we watch all this from the gallery, who do we see? Which Jesus do we behold? The soldiers, it's clear, isn't it? They see only a Jewish prisoner who's to be taunted and abused, dehumanized and derided. He's an opportunity to let off steam at the expense of an insignificant other person. The religious authorities, well, it turns out we get the second charge. He's not just a blasphemer, this Jesus. He is a traitor as well. Look with me at verse 12. Second half, if you let this man go, Pilate, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar. See what they're saying? Jesus is claiming to be a king. So if he's opposing Caesar, well, he's a traitor. Isn't he, Pilate? Not like us. We love Caesar. Verse 15, they shout, take him away, crucify him. Shall I crucify your king? Pilate asked. We have no king but Caesar. This whole passage, it's filled with pain and sadness. But in the words at the end of verse 15, we have perhaps some of the most painful. Because as leaders of God's people, the chief priests, they should be crying out, we have no king but God. But that's not what they say. So keen are they to hold on to their position and power, so eager are they to be rid of this Jesus, they gladly pledge allegiance to the emperor, the Caesar instead. The Caesar who Rome, they would have a special service to claim he is the divine one. So it seems the words of the first commandment, I am the Lord your God, have no other gods before me. Well, that's long been forgotten by these leaders of Israel. So yet they accuse Jesus of betrayal. Well, here once again, we have true treachery. Here is the real betrayal. Pilate, he betrays his conscience. Why? Well, in a bid to maintain his reputation and standing. Pilate knows as well as we do that human power comes from who you know. And he knows Caesar. He doesn't want to jeopardize that at any cost, even if it means sentencing an innocent man to his death. But the Jewish leaders, they betray their God and their king. And the result is in verse 16, finally, having declared Jesus to be innocent three times, finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. As I draw to a close, we mustn't miss the great exchange that has taken place during this trial. See, at the end of chapter 18, Pilate offers to release Jesus. It was a customary thing that would happen around the time of the Passover. He says, look, I can release Jesus to you. And they say, no, give us Barabbas. Barabbas, who is a violent man, a rebel, an insurrectionist, took part in an uprising, a terrorist, we might say, today. That's who they want released, not Jesus. So Barabbas is released. Barabbas, whose name means son of the Father. So now it's Jesus who stands in Barabbas' place. Jesus who stands where the condemned criminal should. So in the place of Barabbas, the son of the Father, we now have Jesus, the son of God, the Father. Innocent condemned in the place of the guilty. The hour has come. Pilate hands him over. Well, as I finish, let's remember that before all this took place, chapter 17, do you remember Jesus' prayer? He prays that at his crucifixion, people would see his glory, that we would see the display of his divine goodness, that at his crucifixion, people would see who Jesus really is. Yes, he's the man. He bleeds just like us. But he's the Son of God, man. He is the King. Is that the Jesus we behold? Who is not only suffering with us, but suffering for us. As he is lifted up on that cross, he is sentenced as a traitor. But it's for our betrayal, our acts of rebellion against God's true King. He's condemned as a blasphemer. But it's for all the times we fail to recognize his divinity. He's declared a criminal so that you and I might be declared innocent. And he is there in weakness, but it is there he has the power to save. See, as Jesus stands on death row, do we behold that he stood there to rescue us, for us? Do we behold that he took our place, faced our charges, bore our judgments, so that we can go free? In the words of the Apostle Paul, do we behold how there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus.